The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard, on corners in town. Like a cancer that silently spreads, there's an unspoken fear. We're on our way down. We must take America back. Main Street to Wall Street, cities and states, Washington, D.C. Before it's too late, there's not long. We need leaders who lead us, not stick us and bleed us, then ransom our future and our children's back strong. As liberty weeps, our forefathers spin in their graves. Pray God will bless some way out of this mess. We must take the miracle back.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is the National Intel Report. I'm your host, John Stadtmiller, with you on this 25th day of November 2014. And I usually have Andy Hoffman on, what is this, the third Tuesday of the month, fourth. This is the fourth one. He will be joining us next month in his regularly scheduled time. Today, however, I am not going to be talking about Ferguson, Missouri, except to say this. Renee from North Carolina, you were right. That was a false story that was planted about Officer Wilson getting beat up and his eye socket fractured. My deference to you, dear lady. All right. On today's program, you might have heard this guy on this network before. His name is Clint Richardson. And I also have T.J. McCann on from Pennsylvania. And what we're going to be talking about today and trying to make some sense of what is going on out there in the courts, with the common law juries, you know the drill. I was going to try to have Eric Madsen on today, but you know what? I thought, no, we've got to have a rudimentary understanding of what we're dealing with. And when you think you know what you're dealing with, somebody dives down a rabbit hole, does extensive research, goes in, ferrets out the real and true meanings of the words being used, and then you find out what you thought was real, what you knew, wasn't really what you actually thought it was. It's like the Matrix, folks. It has been created, it is controlled and manipulated, and we are but small bit players in the Matrix. And as long as we behave ourselves, we're pretty much left alone. Well, how shall I say, qualify alone? If you go along to get along, you'll survive as long as the powers that be want you to survive. You have no cause of action. You have no grievance. You have no input. You are just there. Do I have TJ?
Indeed, I'm here.
Hello,
TJ. Howdy, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
And Clint Richardson, are you there, sir?
Yes, welcome to your show.
Guys, I guess the way to start this is Rod Class gun case in Washington, D.C. And Rod Class, I will not say anything bad about the man and what he's trying to do. Because what we're trying, we, by way of extension, I guess, if we're patriots and we want to see the best and the Constitution restored in this country, these people are working towards ways and avenues in which to accomplish that. We also have a guy by the name of Terry, I do believe his name is Trammell, down in Florida. And TJ, you put me on to this one. Looks like they're going to try to lock this guy up in jail for the rest of his life because he was on a grand jury down there, an impaneled grand jury, and then kind of misused his post to supplant that grand jury in Florida in the Third Circuit with the common law grand jury. And
yeah,
they didn't like that.
Yeah, he did some things that were ill-advised. And I knew of Terry Trussell because I had some limited involvement with Operation American Spring, and that I was really hoping that would be a movement that could force some restoration of the Constitution. And I did whatever little part I could to try to get that movement to rely more heavily on references to the Constitution. And Terry Trussell was a member there, and I knew of him vaguely, although didn't have any really direct interactions with him.
Yeah, well, who was the colonel who was heading this thing up?
Colonel Harry Riley.
Yeah, and the one thing, excuse me, gentlemen, the one thing that I didn't like about this is we were all show up in Washington, D.C., million or millions, plural strong, and we all go there armed.
Yeah, he was that, and then there was also plans to have militia on the shores of Virginia,
yeah.
Obviously not to go into D.C.
Yeah.
In case things should hit the fan. But what really bothered me was the Phase 3 plan that involved setting up a tribunal. And he had a list of like 8 or 10 names of persons in government currently whose ideals he liked. He said the tribunal should be staffed with people of the ideals such as so-and-so and so-and-so. And the problem was there's no place in the Constitution for this tribunal to be set up. The government hasn't set up this court and its authority to run the government while the government is being restructured. And so basically that tribunal would be something taken right out of the military martial law handbook, and it, you know, by definition is entirely outside of the Constitution. So how are you restoring the Constitution by a process that essentially rejects the Constitution?
Well, and here's what I've gleaned so far, and I think I even said this to you, Clint, that back in the day when we were starting this country, we knew we didn't want to be under the king's rule. So we were starting a whole new rule, so to speak. And it was easier to build something anew than fast forward to today. We're trying, in our best hopes and beliefs, to restore the constitutional republic. But that's going to be a little bit harder, because my problem has been with this organization or that organization or just Eric Mattson. And again, I don't want to speak ill of people, and I don't want people to get the impression that I think because I don't agree with them that they're not doing the right thing. The spirit is there. I can appreciate and understand that. But a proper course of action, what we're trying to do is unseat what we have determined to be the de facto with the de jure. And that is, and where's our avenue to do that? Where's the bureaucrat's office that I go and sit down and have my grievances and address those and then get hard, concrete answers to that? What bureaucrat and what agency do I talk to? Where is my redress of government? They're trying to do it through the courts, of which I can understand. But the courts aren't having any of it.
Yeah, part of the problem, and we touched on this when we were talking earlier, John, is that what we have is institutionalized corruption. And so there really is no singular person or authority to confront and charge with fixing things. Even the Supreme Court operates by precedent, which is a built-up of a series of corruptions over time.
All right, well, gentlemen, we've got to take the break here. I don't know if you can hear the bump there, Clint. If not, we'll bleep up the return to you. T.J. McCann, Clint Richardson, Corporation Nation, which just happens to be on this network from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time, Monday through Friday. Clint, I'm compelled to do this to try to set the stage here. And I want people to understand that we're, some people have called us truthers. Well, that's more connected with 9/11. Other people, constitutionalists. Well, there were problems with the Constitution that were big enough you could drive a tractor trailer through sideways. And people want to disavow themselves from that. What we have here is a failure to communicate. No. What we have here is a construct of man's imagination. And without getting too Rod Serling and Twilight Zone on you, I have done something in my life that has changed my perspective on just about everything that I see and hear. And that's simply this. And I related this story to you earlier today, Clint. And on my laptop, not my operating system, but, you know, when you turn on your computer, you can put whatever background screen that you want. Well, the one that I chose was from 2003, the Hubble Space Telescope, with the deep field photographs that they did. Now, what they did is they looked for a point in space. Now, we're in the Milky Way galaxy, a spiral galaxy, hundreds of billions of stars. And we picked a point in the night sky that looked the darkest. They aimed the satellite at it, took 122 different photo sessions, which was basically time-lapse photography, to bring out light. Now, to give you an idea of how big this little area of the universe was, you've got your arm extended, you've got a regular number 2 yellow pencil clenched in your fist. And on top of that is a standard size eraser. That is the area or the field that they photographed 122 times. What they discovered should have set mankind on a future course unlike he has ever known. What they saw was literally 10,000 galaxies dating back to almost the beginning of this universe. And that was representation of 1/24,000 of the night sky or the universe. Now, just to give you a further indication of how big the universe that we know of, they call it the known universe, is 92 billion years across. Well, in space, there's really no up or no down, but 92 billion years across from whatever your vantage point. Now, that would mean light traveling at 186,000 miles per second for 92 billion years. And then comes the question, if that's the end, what's on the other side? Which is another question entirely. But I say that, and I took this perspective a couple of years ago, and I started to see how we as human beings, searching, we need to know answers. We have to have facts. This is the way we're wired. But what we have is a rudimentary understanding of the planet we live on and who we are as a species and the world we live in versus a universe that's 12, 13, 14 billion years old. And what I discovered is simply this, gentlemen. When there's a blank space dying to be filled with an answer or a proposition of some sort, we're more than able to fill that void to make ourselves feel more comfortable. I don't know the answer to that, but what I have discovered, gentlemen, is simply this. We don't know a whole hell of a lot about anything, but we pretend that we do. Now, now that's pretty deep stuff, but...
Uh-oh.
That's a big rabbit hole.
Well, see, and you know, the problem, John, the problem is that, see, we are down the rabbit hole. We live our lives in a complete fictional construct. That's called the legal fiction, the law, right? We act as artificial persons. We do things in commercial activity, which commerce stands for traffic. Traffic means commerce, so really it's human trafficking when we talk about commerce. We do everything in a sort of an artificial world, a fictional world. Well, that is the rabbit hole. See, the problem is not that we can't that we need to go down the rabbit hole. The problem
is
we're looking for the entrance to the rabbit hole, but we never look up to see that we're already in it.
Yeah.
See, that's the problem, is that we live in under these fictional things. You know, whatever you want to call it, religion, government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I was taking some copious notes here, just to give you an example of how much we don't know. Because, you know, I'm a man of terms. I started studying language, you know, found out that the legal language means something completely opposite than the vernacular or common language. So let me give you some definitions. Now, why don't I like common law, for instance? What is common law? Well, let's separate terms. We know what law is. Law can be basically anything if you put a word in front of it. So what does common mean? Well, you know, basically belonging to, you know, equally to more than one, et cetera, et cetera. The common privileges of citizens, et cetera. But what it really means is the terms general and public are part of that. Universal. Okay, what else? If we keep looking. Oh, okay, this is out of Webster's 1828 dictionary. Common means prostitute. Lewd. Oh, wow. I don't know if I want to do that, but as a citizen, that's what I'm doing. I'm being a prostitute. I'm going under the government's fiction. What else does it mean? Usual, ordinary. Oh, vulgar. Oh, the mass of illiterates. Oh, so the people. The general public, the people and public are referring, and common are referring to the mass of illiterates. You see, we need to be governed. We need to be forced into a citizenship, state of servitude, a state of citizenship to a law created by man, because we're not responsible enough to have our own law, to define our own terms, and to live in sort of this do no harm concept of the laws of nature. So when you tell me that I should be under common law or that I should have a common law court, okay, I tell you, way.
And Clint, what you did earlier today, and folks, excuse me, you weren't part of that conversation that went on for 50-some minutes, but Mr. Richardson here just flat blew me away because he kept asking me, do you understand the definition of this word? And I would have to admit, no, I don't. I felt like I was being schooled because I was. And some people, Clint, will look at this. Seriously, some people will look at this. Oh, well, words, that's just semantics. No, it is not. Not in the rule of law. There is no error for equivocation. It is exact. No. It means exactly what they say it means, but we do not understand how that terminology is being used.
Sure, so you consider it an art form. They call it terms of art. Well, the legal language is a term of art. The language of biologists and doctors and scientists and all the different art forms or artifices out there all have their own terms of art. So if I'm going to talk to a botanist, I'd prefer to know their language. Well, if I'm going to speak as if I know what the heck I'm doing, I'm going to have to know the legal language, which, by the way, is pretty much the complete opposite of the vernacular, or what's called the common, vulgar, massive illiterate language that we use, the language of emotion and love and all those things. Well, the legal language doesn't have any morals, ethics, or values. No, it assigns artificiality to everything. So one of the other words you used was arms. Guns. I'll finish that when we get back.
All right. And TJ, I want to bring up what you had asked me about. When was the country basically flipped? And I think we pretty much agreed that it was after the Civil War. So we'll go into that as well. And, folks, we will open up the phones, but only into the next hour. If you call in now, I'm going to leave you in queue. Back right after this. We are back. And to be fair to Mr. McCann, TJ, you're in the position of having two radio talk show hosts talking, and you're not used to interjecting. So, but when you must, you must. So do not feel shy.
Okay. Reach out right. and digitally slap us.
There you go. But first, right. which segues me into this, you were saying, Clint.
Well, okay. So, see, it's the fact that we don't actually have our terms defined as what we're acting. So we're acting as citizens of the United States. Well, those aren't the same kind of citizens that was back, you know, in the day of the Constitution, when the Constitution wasn't suspended, which it is, and we'll talk about that later. So we have to know what the word arms actually means. One of the greatest fallacies of our time is the notion, and I call it the common or vulgar notion, that arms just means guns. Now, if you think about that for a moment, you'll realize how ridiculous that is. Now, when we look up the term arms, and I go specifically to Bouvier's 1856 Law Dictionary, because that dictionary was specifically chartered by Congress to be the dictionary to go to when you want to know the terms of the Constitution and what they mean. Okay?
And that left a hole in Webster's heart, I can tell you.
Yeah. So if we look up the word arms, first, if we look at the Constitution, the Constitution is very clear with certain terms. They will capitalize certain terms, and arms is one of those terms that is capitalized. And that means it's a proper noun and not just a general vulgar noun. All right? So what is arms defined as? One definition says anything that a man wears for his defense, or takes in his hands, or uses in anger, etc., etc. The Constitution says that we have well-regulated militia, and therefore they need to keep and bear arms. But again, arms is capitalized. So what does that mean? Well, let's go to the next definition. Arms means heraldry. Signs of arms are drawings painted on shields, banners, and the like. The arms of the United States are described in the resolution of Congress of June 20th, 1782. Just go ahead and read the seal of the United States. So we go to the seal of the United States. We see that it says the seal used by the United States in Congress assembled shall be the seal of the United States, meaning that it is the arms of the United States. Oh, and it explains e pluribus unum, annuit conceptus, novus ordo seclorum, welcome to the new order, basically. E pluribus unum, out of many one, which means you have a dictator, one body corporate, you know, all these things. So what is arms if it's heraldry? Oh, so we have the right to bear our family name over that of the United States. You see, when you become a citizen, you become enfranchised. You give up your right to bear arms. You give up all of your inheritable rights. You become a citizen. You become common. You become vulgar. Heraldry is genealogy. The blazoning of arms and ensigns memorial is genealogy. You see, the right to bear arms should be protected by guns. Your right to bear arms has nothing to do with carrying guns. You carry guns to protect all of your rights. You don't have a right to granted by government to carry arms. You carry arms for the purpose of protecting your right to bear arms. You know,
yeah.
So our terms are so wrong when it comes to these things. So you got a guy going to court calling it gun rights when the concept of the right to bear arms meant that we had a militia of the state. They bore state arms. They bore the symbol of the state or the symbol of their community, and they fought against any centralized government by having the right of inheritable rights, the right of family, the right of ensigns memorial. This is why the arms of the United States, those aren't guns. It's the seal of the United States. That is the United States arms.
Right.
And Clint, let me ask you, if this is true, then what about the founder statements in the Federalist Papers or the statements they made independently that the purpose, the importance of our right to keep and bear arms is to protect us from a tyrannous government? They're obviously not talking about some sort of emblem or shield.
Absolutely, that's what they're talking about. Absolutely.
So my family crest is going to protect me from a tyrannous government? Mm.
You have to contemplate what it means before you can understand what it means. You have to really think about it. And you have to look it up in the dictionaries, and you have to define the terms. Well, okay, answer me this. Why did they, what does the militia have to do with the right to bear arms? I mean, why did they put...
Back then, the militia, the people of a community, and anybody that's of age to protect the community, right, they were to protect themselves. And how did
they do that? Do you think they did that while wearing the American flag?
Of course not. But they didn't do that by raising their clan crest up in the air.
Right. Well, actually, the state flag or the flag of their community or whatever. So what happened to the militia? It got altered.
These were farmers that brought their own guns and they banded together. Sometimes they drilled together on the village green.
They weren't regarding the right to do that from the United States. They were doing that as a right granted from God, from the natural law to protect your rights to not be harmed. What happened to the militia? It got turned into the National Guard. What insignia, what arm do they bear? Bear means to carry. Insignia of the United States. That's why the militia is so important. That's why the ability for the militia to carry their particular arms, to bear the right arms against the United States, is so important.
Because this was, this was a confederation of states. It is us that formed the federal government, and they had their rules, and they were hard and fast rules of the Constitutional Republic. Here is the box that you're in, and you're not allowed to get out of that box. And this is going to be part of the discussion today. I don't want to get too bogged down with terminologies or any confluence of any sort, but only to say this. We created the federal government. We created not a centralized government, but a government with very strict, don't color outside the lines parameters. What has happened since then is, well, we've had many things that have happened. We had a civil war, of which the South, Texas, and all those that were on the South side lost. We had Reconstruction. We had a new definition of citizenship. But more importantly, what we ended up with was the wet dream of the Federalist. They wanted centralized power, or they wanted a central government. And that's what we have today. Not the United States of America, the United States.
The Federalists, this is kind of a misperception. The Federalists didn't want an all-powerful federal government. What they wanted was to marginally increase the federal government.
Marginally increase, but to have the influence over the states in venues that they thought that they were smarter than the states were.
Well, those venues were only the things that the states themselves could not individually exercise, such as the right to coin currency, or the right to negotiate treaties, or the right to raise an army for the defense of all the states,
or the responsibility to guard our borders.
Which isn't happening.
Yeah.
By the way, Clint, I heard you last night talking about signature and nature and things like that, and I found it interesting that you brought up common law. Because I just went on an internet rant talking about common law and misperceptions about the quote-unquote common law grand jury. The common law is really just the cumulative decisions of the courts as far as general practice and application that have not been written down in any sort of statute.
Or common use, yeah.
Yeah, in some respects, you can look at it as basically the practice for the commoner, which the House of Lords and the House of Commons did not turn into statute. It's generally things that a philosophy that is kind of a catch-all for them to reference, but it really doesn't have anything to do with our rights. It doesn't have anything to do with protecting our rights. We inherited it from Britain being British colonies, upon inheriting it, the only place that it was really recognized was in early state practices and never in the federal constitution. In 2009, Antonin Scalia said that the common law is no more. He was talking to the Federalist Society. It said the common law is no more.
TJ, hold that thought. We've got a break. We'll be right back. All right. We are back talking with TJ McCann from Pennsylvania, Clint Richardson, Corporation Nation. By the way, Clint, I want to reserve about 5 minutes at the end of today's broadcast for you to, and I to have a little conversation directed at the listening audience. TJ, we got interrupted by that crass commercialism. Go ahead. TJ, you got to take your mute off.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
There you are.
I was trying to find it.
Dead air.
Yeah. Back in 2009, Scalia said to the Federalist Society at a meeting in Washington, he said, the common law is gone. The federal courts never applied the common law, and even in the state courts, it's codified now. But back as early as the ratification of the Constitution, George Mason, called the father of the Bill of Rights and considered one of the founding fathers, stated at that time during the Virginia ratification that in 1788 that the common law of England is not the common law of these states. So basically, we've got a misperception about what's going on with the common law. And in fact, Terry Trussell seems to have been operating under a misperception in his actions in Florida regarding the significance of that common law jury that he went and formed while he was the foreman of another state. Grand jury, and this created a conflict of interest, at minimal.
Well, let me just say one thing. Now, again, we'll talk about this and prove it, but the important thing to know is that we are operating under a de facto government, okay? I think everybody in the listening audience kind of understands that that means illegitimate. It means it is something that is acting as government when it actually has no authority or jurisdiction to do so, which means that the only way it can do that is to operate through force, okay? And that means basically that it operates out of the executive branch. Executive simply means force. Your sheriff is the executive of the county. He is in charge of the force. The courts wouldn't exist without the sheriff there to make sure and bump some heads. The prisons wouldn't exist without the sheriff and the marshals, which are the executive branch of government, okay? Likewise, the president is the executive. He's in charge of the military. Now, it's very important to know that we cannot commit treason against this imposer government. I can't remember what definition it was that I found that, but I started realizing that the reason that they don't ever use treason anymore is because they are in treason. The government that stands right now is actually the treasonous government, de facto, illegitimate, illegal, unlawful, whatever you want to call it. So I looked up some words. I'm saying, well, they call us words like terrorists or insurgents or whatever, but they never actually use the word treason because you cannot stand in treason against something that is illegitimate, illegal, unlawful. There's no treason. So what is an insurgent? All right? Again, from Bouvier's. An insurgent is one who is concerned in an insurrection. He differs from a rebel, because a rebel is always understood in a bad sense, or one who unjustly opposes the constituted authorities. Insurgent may be one who justly opposes or lawfully opposes the tyranny of constituted authorities. All right, so the colonists who opposed the tyranny of the English government were insurgents. Wow. So every time we go over, a president uses an executive order instead of a declaration of war, uses his soldiers to go over and inhabit, occupy, attack another country, he calls them what? Oh, those insurgents are coming after us. Oh, well, who are the insurgents? Yeah, those are the people that live there, that are opposed to the attacking force, the illegitimate attacking force. Folks, I'm sorry to tell you this, but that's what the United States, that central government thing, that corporate body, it's acting under military occupation. And for that, we'll get into the Liebert Code and the state of emergency and all that. But I want you to understand there is no such thing as treason against this imposer actor government that we have. And it's very clear when you actually study what treason is, because treason, how can you commit treason against something that is unlawful?
The problem with using the terms de facto and de jure governments to distinguish what's going on is those terms were originally set apart to differentiate when, for instance, a country has a coup and the legitimate government flees to somewhere else. And they are the de jure government. They are the rightful government. And then what's left behind, what takes over, is the de facto government.
That's exactly what's happening.
Well, we can't really point to anything and say this is the de jure government.
I can't.
And DJ?
Let me give you an example.
Okay.
Let me give you an example. All right. We have the original post office, which has been there since Franklin's days. And we have the United States Postal Service, which is a corporate body to offer us a service as customers. So which one do I want to use? Do I want to use the Postal Service as a member of the nation, or do I want to be a customer to government? You know, if you notice, the government calls us customers in almost everything that we get from it now. Right? That's because we don't acknowledge the government that's just sitting there unoccupied. So you go to the post office, you go up to the desk, and you ask them where the actual post office is. And you say, I just got a letter here from someone who sent me a donation. And this is what the letter says. It has a 3-cent stamp on it, because that's all it costs to send a letter in the post office. If you're not sending it first class, and you're not falling for all the tricks, the corporate tricks, the for-profit system that's set up over the actual United States of America. So 3-cent stamp, and then it costs 6 cents per ounce to send a package. That's it. Here's what it says. It's addressed to me, non-domestic. All right? Not domestic. Without the United States. So not within the United States. The post office wasn't set up in this current quote-unquote United States corporation. So it's without the United States. Care of my address. It's sent from non-domestic without the United States. And here's the little wavy line saying that, yes, indeed, 3 cents is all it takes. The government is sitting there virtually not being used. When you go to court, you can find it there, too, because it has to be there for the de facto to exist over the de jure. Okay? To find it, you have to go through the court clerk. Not the clerk of the court, because that's just a secretary. You have to go to the court clerk, who is in charge of the whole court, including the judges, has the highest bond, and the court clerk can actually issue a default judgment without a judge. That is the de jure notion of government. So it exists. It is there, but it has retreated until we actually do something about it. Not our government, because we always want our government to fix things for us. That's why I'm saying we need to bear our arms. We need to say no more central corporation taking over the notion of a compact between states.
The de jure government is the court clerk?
Court clerk on the court of record. But we don't have judges. We have
where'd the rest of the government go?
What do you mean, where did the rest of the government go?
Well, the rest of the legitimate government that was replaced by the de facto government. We can't just have court clerks surviving from that. I guess what I'm trying to get at here is the fact that, and John kind of touched on this earlier, is we have been corrupted by degrees. There was no singular event that took over and replaced a constitution with another constitution, and no legitimate government that was replaced by an illegitimate government.
Well, there again, that's not true. I'm sorry to disagree with you and do so with fact, but let me read you the Nevada State Constitution. Now, all constitutions had to be redone.
That constitution was written by martial law government under Lincoln and includes additions that are contrary to the Constitution. That represents a deviation from the Constitution. For instance, the federal government
had
more authority. Yeah. Well,
okay, well, gentlemen, we have to take top of the hour break, and just in time. My head was starting to hurt. But we'll continue this conversation on the other side of the top of the hour break. My guest today, Clint Richardson, Corporation Nation. If you haven't heard the show, you need to really listen in. He, like others, are giving up a lot to do what we are compelled to do. T.J. McCann from Pennsylvania, stand by. Second hour coming up, and I will give the signal when the time is to open up the phone line. So everybody hang in there. Back in six.
The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard, on corners in town, like a cancer that silently spreads. There's an unspoken fear, we're on our way down. We must take America back, Main Street to Wall Street, cities and states, Washington, D.C. Before it's too late, there's not long. We need the who lead us, not stick us and bleed us, then ransom our future and our children's, that's wrong. We must take America back, as liberty weeps, our forefathers spin in their graves. Pray God will bless some way out of this mess. We must take America back.
We're back, ladies and gentlemen. The second hour of the National Intel Report on this Tuesday, November 25th, 2014. And with me on the program today, Clint Richardson. His program is on this network, 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time, and that is Corporation Nation. And T.J. McCann from Pennsylvania, friends with Tom Terrific up there, Mr. T, or Tom D., however he goes by, it's almost as if on any given day that what he likes to be called. But I call him the savior that came down to technically go through this entire network as a network administrator, and he did a fine, fine job. Gentlemen, let's digress here for a second. Before we get into the Nevada issue, I think what we should set the stage for is, how did we get to where we're at right now? And by that I mean, yeah, we Civil War, later on we saw other things enacted. 1933, we know what happened then, but we need to go through the timelines to make sure that people are on the same page. Okay, now, having said that, we all know how we started. We built something new. We didn't have to deconstruct anything. We just had to cast off the old. We're in a position today where we're trying to reinstitute what once was, but it is not going to allow us to do it. Now, we have commercial code out there. We have commerce law. We have administrative procedures, and we've seen what they've done through the court system in order to administer law to us, supposedly under the concept of protections. Well, no, au contraire, it makes us extremely vulnerable to the whims and wishes of the regulatory overzealous. We want to control, and we're from the government, and we're here to help. So let's go back here. What was the major thing? Was it the Civil War that flipped this country, and then all the constructs that were added at a later date?
Well, yeah, I mean, so the important thing to understand about the Civil War is that it technically, this is going to sound probably strange to people, it didn't end. I'm looking for the quote actually right now, but the Appomattox Courthouse, which is now a museum, where the end of the war was basically agreed to, the surrender, is very clear when it says there was no treaty or proclamation that ended the war, which is a requirement of the end of the war. So technically, we've never gone out of a state of emergency or a state of war, if you will, from the Civil War, which means that we've been ruled without constitutional notions, essentially. And then that was made official in 1933 by Congress, where they made all but suspended the Constitution when it comes to emergency statutes and emergency declarations and orders from the president. So all the president has to do is say, well, there's an emergency. We now have a war against the emergency, and I'm going to call it terrorism. Terrorism is the emergency, and we're at war with it. Therefore, anything that's passed is under the doctrine of necessity, and that's a doctrine that's in the Constitution. It's in all constitutions all over the world. We don't have a unique constitution. In fact, Washington is quoted as saying there's nothing unique about our declaration or our constitution. It's old stuff that's just been rehashed into ours. So basically, we've lived under the doctrine of necessity, and necessity knows no law, which means all law, constitutional law, and it is regulated by what's called the Lieber Code, a Jewish gentleman named Francis Lieber, who wrote the rules of war, and that was implemented again back at the Civil War time, became part of the Hague, and it became part of U.S. code. So we literally live under a military occupation. Now, you talked about the courts earlier. Well, folks, we don't have a third branch of government. We have a Department of Justice in the executive branch, because everything's run out of the executive branch. All of the Bar Association, all the judges, everything is run out of a executive cabinet, basically, called the Department of Justice. That's where all of your quote-unquote courts are sitting. They're not sitting in a third branch of government. They're sitting in the executive. That's important because the executive rules by force. When you go to court, technically, and it's hard to prove, but you can see it every once in a while. And I'm making a documentary about this, by the way. You're going to a military court. You're not going to a normal magistrate type of situation. You're going to a justice from the Department of Justice. It's very difficult to get yourself into an actual lawful court. They're all in commercial capacity at this point. There is no justice system. What we have is a simulation, a simulacra of the justice system that actually is completely against what the original intent was.
So you're, in essence, I would be correct in saying that since 1933, we have been under a martial law circumstance, or at least militarily occupied.
Well, we can certainly verify that quite easily by simply going to congressional record. And I always like to go to the actual source. Call me crazy. In 1933, in the Act of March 9th, 1933, Title 1, Section 1, here's what Congress said. Roosevelt asked for emergency powers, and they gave it to him. And he was a virgin president then. The actions, regulations, rules, licenses, and orders, which are executive orders, and proclamations heretofore and hereafter taken, promulgated, made, or issued by the President of the United States or the Secretary of the Treasury since March the 4th, 1933, pursuant to amended U.S. Code 12, Section 95A, that's 12 U.S. Code, Section 95A, are hereby approved and confirmed. What does that say? That means that any executive order, presidential proclamation, or what's the other one called? Rule, regulation, action, or anything the president does is approved and confirmed. He doesn't need to go to Congress. Congress already approved all of the president's actions. Therefore, every time the president declares a state of emergency, we have terrorism, we have swine flu, we have now shingles, we have Ebola, we have the war on drugs, we have so many. We're even still in a state of emergency against Cuba, for God's sake. All right? They didn't take that off the books. They keep redeclaring every year, which is a rule of Congress, a law of Congress, that the emergency still exists. So what does that mean? That means that everything that everybody's complaining about, everything is based on the declaration or the law of necessity. Because when you declare war, and they say that emergency is the same as war, when you declare a war against an emergency, it is the same power of necessity as war. And again, necessity knows no law. And all of this is in congressional record.
Clint, and we got to go to break here, but understand, ladies and gentlemen, that they always had to have a war on something, a war on ignorance, so a war on drugs. And the final coup, the war on terrorism that is never ending, and they will necessarily do whatever and however they need to achieve their means. We'll be right back.
Get ready for Real Talk Radio. You're listening to the National Intel Report with your host, John Stadtmiller.
We are back. Gentlemen, I got involved in a conversation during the commercial break. We never break around here. And forgive me, I forgot where we left off. I think, what were we talking about, Clint?
Girl Scout cookies. and the notion that the Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts are now almost wholly funded by Homeland Security.
Really? Are you seriously? I did not know that.
Absolutely.
Well, they say you learn something new every day. Here's the situation we find ourselves in. We are in a failing and a failed economy. I don't think there's any question. And the people's attitude, gentlemen, is we are not coming back from this one. The United States of America is dead. And I'm having a hard time with that concept. Because yeah. That being a construct that was put together by men, screwed up by men, and here we sit with a screwed up system, but we're not wannabes or we're not has-beens. We can be again, but the only way to do this is through education and make people understand as to what we are supposed to be as a country, as a society, a culture, the form of government that we're supposed to have, and our participating roles in said government. Now, we thought we had the government settled with a certain amount of rules that would keep them in check, but evidently that was not the case, and here we sit today.
Well, so John, I'll let TJ take over, but I want to make it clear that when the United States, after the Civil War and after the 14th Amendment, all the Reconstruction Acts were passed, what happened is that we were all enfranchised into a corporate structure. So that means that we lost our arms. We lost our family name, and our family name became in the legal parlance, a surname. And the name is a corporate name, and it's owned by the United States. So everything that we possess, that we buy, that we purchase, that we register, including our children, now belongs to the corporate structure because we're acting in a legal capacity instead of a lawful one. We're acting in artifice, in artificiality.
And evidently, right? And evidently there are branches or agencies, and I never saw an agency mentioned once in the Constitution, that have been out there informing the shiny badge guys with the six guns in the various states, the several states, that somehow that there is a danger more dangerous than ISIS or give it a name. We're the new terrorists. We're the sovereign citizens.
Exactly. We're insurgents, like I said.
Yeah.
But if there's only one thing, there should be only one thing that we go into the next election, and that is Okay, there's only one problem here, and that is the state of emergency. Because with the state of emergency allowed to be declared by the president, Congress and the president aren't in competition. The only way Congress can pass such unconstitutional things is if there is a declared state of emergency by the president. So that's why they created the law, to allow the president to declare an emergency, declare a state of permanent war, which means necessity rules and necessity knows no law. So the Constitution is all but suspended when it comes to the emergency. But the only thing we should be concentrating on is to force our quote-unquote representations, our representatives, to end the ability for the president to declare a national emergency and to end any statute, presidential order, or anything else that's been declared by the president or Congress, such as the Patriot Act, because that is all based on the fact that the Constitution does not apply to a state of emergency or necessity. You see, okay, that's the only thing that matters. And Clint, everything would go away.
Clint, and you mentioned something to me that Congress actually took up that question back in 1973, 40 years after Franklin Delano Roosevelt kind of took over, and then we go from there.
Indeed, and that was actually referred to in, well, they got together and they were considering whether or not to actually end the this notion of what we're talking about. I got to find it again. I'm sorry, but it was 1973, I believe, was the correct year, and it was a document in congressional record done by the Senate. And it was a contemplation of whether or not to end the national state of emergency, which again is exactly what would end all of these tyrannical things. So they, of course, they don't want to get rid of it, and they decided not to. I'll find the quote here if I can find it. But it's basically it says that Americans have lived all of their lives, especially in our generation, under emergency statutes. Here it is. Okay. Special Committee on the Termination of the National Emergency. This is Senate Report 93-549. Here's the opening statement. Since March the 9th, 1933, the United States has been in a declared national emergency. A majority of the people of the United States have lived all their lives under emergency rule. For 40 years, this was in 73, remember, for 40 years, freedoms and governmental procedures guaranteed by the Constitution have, in varying degrees, been abridged by laws brought into force by states of national emergency. All the unconstitutional stuff that we all complain about comes from the national emergency. And here's what it says. And in the United States, actions taken by the government in times of great crisis have, from at least the Civil War, in important ways, shaped the present phenomenon of a permanent state of national emergency. Now, that, don't just ignore the fact that they said this. Take that to heart, because everything bad that's happening, or if you want to say unconstitutional, is because they don't use the Constitution to see whether or not the law is constant. It doesn't matter anymore, because necessity knows no law.
TJ?
Preston, I would agree. I agree with Clint that we have never rolled back the martial law and the state of emergency, even since the Civil War. And that's a general problem. I think that once we've given government powers, we don't take it back. There's a great video, scary video, of the Iran-Contra hearings, where Ali North is in front, and he's getting interviewed by Senator Inouye of Hawaii. I've got his name wrong.
Inouye.
Thank you. And they question him about the suspension of government and the continuity of government, which Ali North was involved in orchestrating under Reagan. And the speaker brings up the fact that they can't talk about that on the public record.
Right.
And it's scary stuff. To this day, it sends a chill watching me going up. These people are definitely engaging things well beyond the Constitution, and they know it. And they justify it by various means. But, you know.
Well, so what's important is that Congress pretends, they put on a stage show, they say, oh, our hands are tied. You know, president's acting on his own. We can't do anything about it. Truth is, tomorrow they could pass a law that says no more emergency powers from the president. All executive orders would be gone. All unconstitutional law would have to be reconsidered by the courts, who would actually act constitutionally for once. I mean, the whole thing is a stage show. It's all set up to put this fallacious cognitive dissonant sympathy onto the people that says, oh, our poor Congress, they just can't do anything because that president is such a bad guy.
Yeah.
So you have a symbolic death or execution of the president every 8 years. We get a new guy, and we're hopeful for a while. And then he gets executed after 8 years, and the next assassination happens after another 8 years.
Hope
and
change.
We keep hoping it's going to change, but it's an office. The office is the problem, not the man.
All right.
But we've got a bigger problem, I think. And we talk about the incorporation of American things like that.
Okay.
When
DJ,
you get down,
do me a favor. You will have the floor when we get back up. Please pick up exactly where you left off. 3 minute break here. We'll try to squeeze some calls in. If you have specific questions, I don't need any long meandering explanations. All right, we are back. We have three callers in queue here, standby callers. Now, if you would, TJ, pick up where we left off prior to break.
Because John can't remember.
John, I think how you started the program off is what we're looking at, what we can wrap our hands around, and what we can actually do. You know, whether we want to discuss whether the federal government is incorporated or not, it's a debate and discussion worth having. But the fact of the matter is we have a private Federal Reserve that's issuing currency that it doesn't have authority to issue to the federal government, and we're paying for debt on that currency, whether physical or electronic. And then we currently have corporations, global corporations, that are dictating policy, everything from healthcare to things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Companies like Monsanto have revolving doors with offices in the government that are approving things that they're doing and writing laws making Monsanto's genetically modified corn able to infiltrate farmers' normal crops,
right.
And it's the blame of the farmers. Basically, we're under assault by the government from outside entities that are not duly elected and are not operating in our interest. And how do we change that?
Well,
so there again, the bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, was done under emergency. We had a banking emergency.
Right,
that was
yeah.
what the whole thing was about.
Yeah.
So Federal Reserve falls under emergency powers as well. You want to get rid of the bank. Well, then stop saying that we're in a monetary emergency.
So, gentlemen,
it all boils down to this.
Yeah, I was just going to say, to put this in a thimble, that what this does boil down to, Clint, if we do away with the emergency war powers that the president seems to enjoy, you know, stroke of the pen and off we go, that if our Congress that can't seem to do anything correctly, and it always are at loggerheads. I always suggested bringing out the Constitution if you forgot how to play the game. Read the rule book.
It's a stage show.
Yeah, it's a stage show. So short of that, if our vaunted Congress critters would just do away with the emergencies, then we might have a chance of getting this country back on track.
It would actually make the Congress have to follow the Constitution, actually have to consider the Constitution for what it is, which is a limiting document. Right now, they don't have to consider that in their statutes when they create acts.
Yes.
Okay?
Well,
as far as the Federal Reserve goes, remember, it wasn't just the president that was given the authority to pass stuff. It was also the Treasury Secretary. So the Secretary of Treasury, an appointed office, is also just as almost as powerful as the president. So it has to be confirmed by the president. But so the Treasury the Fed is under the Treasury. There's a lot of mythology that I've dispelled when it comes to the Federal Reserve. It is not separate in the way that we like to, you know, the patriot movement likes to say it is, and I've proven that without a doubt. I can send you all the documents. But so remember that everything that the Fed is doing is under the Treasury. All the interest it receives on Federal Reserve notes goes right to the Treasury.
Well, Clint, I could care less if it was an over and under shotgun or a double barreled shotgun standard. It still has the ability to do the same thing. Whether one is under the other, we're under what they have created, no matter who's in charge.
They've created cognitive dissonance. We think that there's competition between the Fed and the Treasury, the Fed and the government, and there's not. We think that there's competition between Congress and the President. There is not. It's all a stage show for our benefit.
Yeah. All right, gentlemen, let's field some calls here. Francis, you're up first. Francis in North Carolina.
Well, hey, fellas. One thing I can say is, wow, if you weren't awake before, you better be now. Because this is like a rude slap in the face if you have not woken up out of the matrix, period.
Well, that's what I do.
Well, that's a heck of a job to be slapping someone up against the head. And quite frankly, as far as one comment I heard about basically getting politicians to let go of such authority or so-called power or whatever, there is no way in Hades that they're going to let go of that kind of control as far as keeping an emergency state in place.
But it's not the control that you think that it is. They would actually exercise control by doing exactly what we just discussed, of doing away with the emergency war powers, or some call it the War Powers Act that has been used on the American people. That would actually put them in control. What they're doing
they'd
right now...
They'd actually be responsible.
Yeah, and what they're doing right now is play-acting and self-aggrandizing.
But isn't the caller saying that they're not going to give up that power?
Yeah.
They're not going to pass
it. Exactly.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They would rather turn over... in their grave or be frozen a cybernetic pot or something to be woken up some 20, 30 years from now just to start the whole crap all over again.
All right, Francis, is there anything else? Because I've got to move on here. I'm running out of time.
No problem. Y'all have a great weekend and have a great holiday.
Thank you, Francis. I appreciate it. Gary in Arkansas. Hello, Gary.
Yeah, I'd like to throw a little bit more into the mix by asking Clint some questions. Clint, how many Clint Richardsons are there?
You mean as far as the name itself?
I guess you could call it the name, but...
There's plenty of enfranchised citizens named by the surname of Clint
Richardson. Yeah.
But only I'd like to say there's only one Clint by my Christian amorphous name.
Correct, but if you go into Styles, hang on a second.
Stop it.
Hugs in the room here with me.
Couldn't tell, Gary. Couldn't tell.
Anyway,
if you go to Styles Manual and one judge lets us out, there are actually 13 different ways that you can spell your name. That goes with punctuation, things like semicolons and dashes, capitalizations, abbreviations, etc.
Putting you in different jurisdictions.
Yeah.
So then the next question I would ask you, how many citizenships do you have?
You got me, man. I bet you can answer that, though.
Yeah, Gary. Get to the point.
You have two citizenships. You have the U.S. citizenship, and then you have the American national citizenship.
Well, I'll tell you what, Gary. I no longer acknowledge any one of them.
Well, that may be true.
My plan is to get rid of all of the artifice, all the numbers, all the names, all everything, including the birth certificate. That is my path in life. So I want to be free of all artifice.
Yeah, but then you will find yourself a man without a country.
not necessarily.
I will find myself a man without the United States.
There
that's all
go.
I'll find.
There you go. Okay.
True, then that means you're going back to American national status. How, what we call or assume that our public officials, what are their citizenships? Are they Americans?
You know, that's an interesting question. Like, we talked about this the other day, that when, for instance, when a judge joins the Bar Association, you know, they do this oath. The Bible says never take an oath, but they take an oath on the Bible, and they do it through God to some foreign thing, some secular thing. So it's really kind of messed up when you think about it. But what are they doing? They're pledging to God. The problem is, God is not a name. So if you're actually pledging to a temporal God, you're actually pledging your allegiance to the Pope, because the Pope is God on earth, according to the church and all that stuff. So it's very interesting when you think about it, because most of these attorneys, when they're pledging their oath, they're sort of expatriating out of the United States and pledging their oath to, like I said, God, the vicar of Christ, the replacement or antichrist, which is the Pope. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. Gary, I thank you for your call. I didn't know where he was going when he was asking those questions, but I see now. Mike,
can I step in here?
Yeah,
well, let's get Mike on. Mike, okay. On, and I'll...
Mike in Colorado. Go ahead,
hey,
Mike.
Gentlemen, great show. Since the Civil War never legally, technically ended, wouldn't it be possible to take a representative from every one of the Union states and simply surrender?
Well, so don't get me wrong. There was something called a. It's very interesting. You know the concept that war is peace. Well, that's actually a true statement, and the ignorance is strength is also very true, because we're all ignorant of all this happening. The war is peace thing can be seen if we look up Presidential Proclamation number 157, I think it is. Which is declaring that peace, order, and tranquility and civil authority now exist throughout the whole of the United States of America in 1866.
Well, hell, our job's done. We can all go home. Mike, hang on a second, and we're going to let TJ finish up. He wanted to interject here. Let's take this quick break, and then I need to carve out about 5 minutes with Mr. Richardson. We'll do all of that, hopefully, after this break. Mike in Colorado, go ahead, sir.
And my point was, wherever we went wrong, that's where I think we need to correct it, because they've just papered over and papered over to get what they want. And as citizens, if it was the 14th Amendment and it was legally ratified, that's where we need to stand. If it was the Civil War ending, that's where we need to stand. We got to pick a spot where we can focus our energy.
Yeah, and what I see the problem has been, and it's not through ill intent or to confuse people, or I like the term cognitive dissonance, to cause conflict in the mind, but I appreciate what everybody tries to do, and the problem I've had is we get into this adversarial position that my approach to the courts or our freedom or this is not like mine, so therefore I'm going to disregard it and I'm going to continue. They're doing it because they don't have an agenda. It's not really ego-driven per se, but it comes to a point where if they end up in a dead end, that's exactly where they stay. But here's the problem. We find ourselves in the exact same position we were before all these expenditures.
Bingo.
Yeah. I mean, we're not has-beens, and we're certainly not wannabes. We have proven that we can run a system of government as long as everybody pretty much stays by the rules, that it's workable. This is my life that I'm dealing with. This is my life that I'm trying to live, and I find it increasingly harder in which to do it. Because I was not the one that created this matrix, they did. And they've made it impossible for me to live in it.
I'm with you.
All right. Mike,
Take care.
Thank you for your call. I think that pretty much sums up the frustrations. I mean, here we sit.
I think that the real problem, you know, he said go back to where we basically went wrong. Well, that can really be easily appointed to. It's when we left our states as state citizens and became federal citizens. We are now no longer acknowledging our states. Our states are not asking what the federal government can do for us. We are asking what we can do for the federal government.
Well,
so
and
we have this central body that we're all part of instead of our states. We're not protecting our states, in other words, which means we're not protecting ourselves.
And what I found really laughable when Rick Perry, as governor of Texas, started to assert, and this was just about in time for the 2012 elections, of which he really wanted to be part of, but nobody wanted him, where he came out and extolling the virtues of the state's 10th Amendment rights. 10th Amendment rights based on what? And you're going to assert your freedom and sovereignty of your state compared to what?
That's the other fallacy that I want to dispel right now, and people don't like it when I say this, but I'm sorry. But if you go back and you read the Constitution, which only has to do basically with the federal government and nothing else, it says very clearly that each state is a republic, and the United States has a duty, an obligation, to protect each republic of each state. It does not say that the United States itself, that corporate thing in Washington, D.C., is a republic. We have to get that out of our minds. It's a federation, okay? The United States is not a republic. Only the states are republics.
Confederation, not really a federation. They're slightly different in that a federation is not voluntary. It's kind of compulsory, whereas a confederation would be more of a voluntary union, and I think that's where we lost it at the Civil War.
Confederation, though, another name or another word for confederation is conspiracy.
Well, okay, so it's Confederation Broadcasting Network or Conspiracy Broadcasting Network. I got to dump the Republic now?
No, Republic is fine. Republic is good because you're talking, but you just got to realize that the only republics that ever existed were each individual state, right? Never the central government.
Go ahead.
Here's the problem. You mentioned republic. If we go by Clint's definition of the republic, like in the 1828 Webster's Dictionary, it only says a representative government, in that we have representatives in our government. But when the founders said in the Constitution that each state is guaranteed a republican form of government, they were saying something more than just having representatives. And if you read the Federalist Papers, you find out that what they're referring to by that republican form of government is something where we don't have like the aristocracy, like the British House of Lords occupying government, but something more than that. They're also saying that we're not a democracy in that there are people representatives representing the people,
okay,
but they're not operating by the will of the people.
TJ, I need 5 minutes at the end of this program. It is at this point you and I are going to depart. TJ McCann, I thank you so much for coming on the network.
Pleasure to meet you, TJ.
Thank you both. You too, Clint. Good talking to you.
Okay, sir.
You too.
Clint, you and I were talking earlier today, and Dan made me aware of this during one of the breaks, that for the first time, and you've been on this network for how long?
A year and a couple months, I think.
Okay.
I think I started in October.
Okay. For the first time, you came up on the air last night and asked for donations.
Oh.
And
yeah. Oh, is that what this is about?
No. Well, kind of, sort of. But I just want to make people understand from what walk of life that you came from. And give me, I'm running out of time here, so give me the thumbnail sketch. You used to have a six-figure a year job, did you not?
I certainly would have one now. I was a Hollywood sound designer, so I'm the guy that put sounds into movies and video games and commercials. And the last thing I worked on was a game called Resident Evil 5, which is a big demonic game. One of the reasons I quit was because it was just getting so bloody and gory, and I was really good at making blood and gore sound good. And so I decided, once I saw an interview with a soldier who basically goes to work each day and gets in a little video game booth, flies a drone over in Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and drops bombs on people and has about a 5% accuracy rate. The rest is collateral damage.
Yeah.
Wet women and children.
That's,
I decided
did
I didn't want to make video games or anything else, for that matter, in the entertainment, which means to enter and hold the mind, industry.
Okay.
And I quit, and I... First thing I did was start a blog, and then I contacted Walter Burian, learned about the CAFR, made a documentary, and I've never sold anything. Everything I do is free. I've got 6 movies out there on the Corporation Nation, and here I am.
and here you are, and you and I were having a conversation. I'm being pressed for time here, and I hate this. You and I had a conversation prior to you coming on the air today. And this is what you want to do. This is what you're compelled to do. You're writing a book. You're making a new movie. And this would be tantamount to me going out and getting a full-time job. It would severely impair my ability to do a network and even to do programming on the network. What is lacking here is a little bit of funding. I mean, and even your hookup here to the network, your mic cord is crapping out, and you don't have the money to replace it, and you really actually need to go on what is called an access. Comrex accesses we can get fairly cheap, used for $1,000, $1,200, whatever the case may be. And that's what you really need to be on. And I told you, Clint, that we have affiliate relations now, but I don't know that your show, because of the subject matter that you do, it's not topical, and here's the hot beat of the day, and this is what I'm going to do, and here's my guest, and blah, 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 blah. The next show, it's totally different. You do a continuum, which is, and I told you that you're probably one of the most valuable programs on this network. Marketable to AM and FM? I don't know. But I know that you have to remain here. And this network has to remain in order to bring people like yourself. You're a passionate man, and so am I. And we need to continue. What is your email?
temporaryinsanity4848@yahoo.com.
temporaryinsanity4848.com. His...
at yahoo.com.
At Yahoo. My apologies. And your website is realityblogger.wordpress.com. Okay, here's the deal. Reality Blogger, only one G in that blogger. So it's
My movies are at thecorporationnation.com, and I put donation buttons up for the first time in probably 2 or 3 years on those sites. So.
But I wanted you people to be aware that this man couldn't possibly do what he's doing, all the endless hours of research. He needs some support, as well as this platform in which we offer the Corporation Nation. Clint Richardson, this has been a fun 2 hours, and we're going to have to do it again.
Anytime, and I appreciate it, man. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Whew, my head's hurting. It's been hurting all day. I've been having these conversations with people like this all day today. I want to thank you all for being here today. Back with you tomorrow with another edition of the National Intel Report. We will see you then.